Beyond VW and Mitsubishi, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Volkswagen and Mitsubishi are both paying the price for cheating on emissions tests, and VW now promises to buy back or fix almost 500,000 polluting vehicles. But some argue it's not just the cars that need fixing.
What's actually broken, arguably, is the testing system itself.
Also, U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia are up, but this reporter says the Saudis use the weapons indiscriminately.
When you're going at a smaller target, you shouldn't be dropping a 2,000-pound bomb.
Plus, saying goodbye to Prince. This super fan in London says he was a once-in-a-generation musician.
I would say in hundreds of years, we will be talking about Prince. We will be talking about this modern-day Mozart.
Those stories ahead on The World. We have a lot to get to today, including the passing of the musician Prince. We'll be hearing from one of his super fans in London later in the show, but we'll start off with our environment team. Remember back in December, there was that rare sense of optimism coming out of the Paris climate talks? Even some of the most pessimistic activists seemed to feel it could be a turning point. Well, now it's time for countries to step up and actually commit themselves to the deal. We're going to hear about that from The World's environment editor Peter Thompson in just a few minutes. But first, there's news for all the Volkswagen owners here in the U.S. driving around with diesel engines the company rigged to cheat emissions tests. VW reached a deal today with U.S. regulators to either buy back or fix 500,000 affected cars. The deal could help calm the waters around VW, but as The World's Carolyn Beeler reports, the company's chicanery is just the tip of the iceberg in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Kelley Blue Book analyst Rebecca Lindelin hazarded a guess today at the message being sent by regulators in this decision.
Don't mess with the government.
Compensation for car owners from VW is expected to reach more than $1 billion. And that doesn't include fees for environmental cleanup and money to promote green automotive technology that haven't yet been set.
This is a pretty substantial financial impact for Volkswagen. So I think if this is the new levels that these fines hold, then I think it could provide a significant deterrent to manufacturers going forward.
This VW ruling may instill fear of sky-high after-the-fact penalties for car manufacturers who cheat. But what it doesn't change is how easy it can be for them to game the system in the first place.
What's actually broken, arguably, is the testing system itself.
The VW scandal is about emissions, but Lindelin says when it comes to gas mileage, there are lots of ways to make cars perform better in the lab than they will in the real world.
So you can do things like overinflate the tires, and then that will give you a better fuel economy result.
She says that happens in the U.S., and it's what Mitsubishi got in trouble for this week in Japan.
You can also do things like seal up the doors and windows with tape, which is also going to make the car more aerodynamic and it give you better fuel economy.
The company Emissions Analytics does real-world testing for cars and compares their results to what automakers advertise. Company CEO Nick Molden says the difference for European cars is striking.
Miles per gallon on average is 22% worse than the sticker. Nitrogen oxide emissions are 4 times the official level on European cars, and that's based on over 750 different makes and models.
Molden says that's partly because of how testing is done in Europe. Car companies there can hire external labs to conduct their emissions testing or do it themselves with regulators watching. Testing is overseen by one country, and once a car is okayed, it's cleared to be sold continent-wide. Greg Archer with the Brussels-based sustainable development nonprofit Transport and Environment sees this system as ripe for abuse.
In Europe, the manufacturers go shopping to choose which authority will approve their vehicles. If they don't like the work that they're doing, then the manufacturer takes its business to another country. This is endemic within the industry.
Emissions tester Nick Molden sees the relationship a bit differently and more kindly. He says that in a competitive market, car companies are understandably looking for the best gas mileage and emissions ratings they can get. So they work with testing houses that know the loopholes.
This is all perfectly legal, and it's a product of regulations that have lots of holes in them.
In the United States, Molden says the system works a lot better, and emissions and gas mileage are generally closer to what's advertised. Car companies test their own vehicles, but the EPA audits that data and does some of its own testing. Importantly, Molden says they also crack down on companies that break the rules. In 2014, the Environmental Protection Agency fined automakers Kia and Hyundai $100 million for selling cars that violated clean air standards.
There's no tradition of that in Europe, really, at all.
Molden believes the kind of blatant cheating that VW did is probably rare here and in places like Japan.
In Europe, I think it's more likely that everyone is doing this optimization activity, but it's probably all legal.
The EU is rolling out new emissions tests in 2017, and Molden says they'll close some of the loopholes manufacturers exploit. Meanwhile, in the U.S., Volkswagen seems likely to avoid a trial on its admitted emissions cheating, but it's still not clear how high the price of Dieselgate will rise. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
From local pollutants now to global ones and to the other half of our environment team, environment editor Peter Thompson. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Carol.
Peter, the last time you and I spoke together here on the show, you were in Paris reporting on the big new climate change agreement that had just been hammered out. Remind us quickly what that agreement actually does to fight climate change.
Well, it commits the countries of the world to holding the rise in global temperatures to well under 2 degrees Celsius, or about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and essentially to make the global economy carbon neutral by the second half of this century.
So what's the big news this week?
The climate deal officially opens for signing tomorrow at the UN. It's the start of a somewhat convoluted process for actually making it go into effect. Normally, something like this would just be sort of a formality, but there's some stuff going on that's made this a good deal more significant. The first is that a record number of countries are planning to sign the agreement tomorrow, something like 160 of 195 who were there in Paris and approved the deal then. And that shows that momentum from the Paris meeting hasn't faded in the months since, as many feared that it would, that there's still a very strong consensus for climate action. Another is that it turns out that with this process now starting, the deal could actually go into effect much earlier than originally anticipated, maybe even this year.
How's that?
It's because of this last-minute change in the Paris Agreement that up until now pretty much escaped anybody's notice, and that is that the effective date was dropped. It had been January 1st, 2020. The final version had no such thing, and it could actually go into effect a lot sooner. For the agreement to take effect, as I said, this is a sort of convoluted process. 55 countries have to sign and ratify it, but enough countries that represent 55% of the world's total emissions also have to sign it. So those are not necessarily the same number.
So tomorrow, 165 countries are signing it. Are any of them the big polluters?
Yes. The biggest two, the U.S. and China, are both signing tomorrow. They then have to go through a process of national approval by either their national legislatures or by their executive. Here in the U.S., that basically means President Obama has to officially sign off it, and then the U.S. will be a party to this agreement.
Is Obama expected to, or will this elude him until the next president comes into office?
He absolutely is expected to. The next president could retract that. But even there's a convoluted process. If any country wants to withdraw from this, they have to wait 1 year after it has gone into effect. And then there's 3 years before that withdrawal takes effect. That's 4 years, essentially the length of one U.S. presidential term.
So what's the practical effect in the real world if this thing does go into effect sooner?
Essentially, it would put a lot of the processes that were built into the Paris deal on a faster track. There were a lot of finer grain decisions that need to be made and institutions that need to be set up under that agreement, and this would start the clock on those sooner. It wouldn't change the deadlines and the targets for action, which just about everybody agrees are insufficient to meet the challenge, but it would start to build momentum for the whole process sooner. And that's a good thing because while this massive diplomatic and political and economic process of responding to climate change gets rolling, the reality of the situation just continues to get worse. I mean, we've seen record high global temperatures for 2014, 2015, the first 3 months of 2016. Part of that's due to the recent El Nino, but scientists say there's also clearly a strong climate change fingerprint to those temperatures. We've seen record warmth in the Arctic this winter, unprecedented early melting in Greenland. We heard on the program last week about the growing warning signs about the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And we continue to have a string of extreme weather events like this week's torrential rains in Houston, which are also likely due at least in part to climate change. So the crisis continues to get worse. And even if the Paris Agreement does go into effect this year, the world would still just be playing catch-up in a big way.
The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Carol.
And we're zooming back to the local now. My colleague Ritu Chatterjee has been living in the Indian capital, Delhi, considered one of the most polluted cities in the world. Now she's in another big city, New York, and breathing easier. She says you hardly ever see blue sky in Delhi.
And one of the first things people notice when they visit Delhi or move to Delhi, and certainly I did when I first moved there in 2013, was your boogers turn black, like within a day.
You're kidding.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. And, you know, particulate matter in the air kills about 600,000 Indians prematurely every year.
Now, we don't hear this about Mumbai, and that's an even bigger city than Delhi. Why is the air in Delhi so bad?
Delhi has a few disadvantages. It's sort of in this bowl. You know, you don't have a lot of air circulation. So air pollution from the cities tends to stay there. And then what happens is that Delhi is right next to some big farming areas, the states of Punjab and Haryana. So every fall, once the farmers harvest their crops, they tend to burn their fields. And so all the particulate matter from those neighboring states comes and like sort of sits on top of Delhi. And on top of that, you have like rampant construction dust. Vehicular pollution from diesel vehicles is awful. And Delhi adds, I think, 1,200 to 1,300 new cars on its streets every day.
I know you're a runner and you actually would jog in New Delhi. What was that like?
So the one good thing that Delhi has going for it, it has the most green cover. So there are lots of beautiful parks. But even then, when you're running, you clearly feel, and I felt this over time, is that it was harder to breathe. And I noticed the difference now that I've moved back to New York, that I tend to run faster. You know, I'm taking deeper breaths while running, which obviously makes me more efficient when I'm running. And I enjoy my run more here than back in Delhi.
I know the government in Delhi has made attempts to limit traffic. I mean, they're clearly aware of the bad air. And so they're allowing odd number license plates on the road one day, even numbers on the next. Is that making any difference?
So just to give you a brief background, the Delhi government started this on April 15th as a 15-day trial. And this is the second time that the government is trying this. The first time it did it was in early January. And the January experiment, initially people grumbled a lot, especially the elite who were used to driving in their cars. They grumbled a lot. But surprisingly, by the end of that first 15-day trial, you know, people became pretty comfortable. You know, there were people who were carpooling willingly, and there was a massive support, unexpected support for the trial. And you felt it in the congestion on the streets, but I believe scientists who were measuring air quality noticed immediately about a 10% reduction in particulate matter.
Ritu, you lived in Delhi for 3 years and now you're back in New York. What was it like to be in New York compared to Delhi?
Carol, it's so nice to be able to breathe in clean air, even though I know people who've lived in New York for a long time do not consider the city's air as clean. But one of my biggest lessons from having lived in Delhi is that I now understand the value of clean air, and clean air is really relative. And so back in Delhi, I would dread stepping out of my apartment. But here in New York, I want to step outside all the time. And it helps that it's spring, the flowers are blooming, and I just enjoy every breath of fresh air I breathe in.
Ritu Chatterjee is a journalist formerly based in New Delhi, is now based in New York. Thanks, Ritu.
Thanks, Carol.
Coming up, the UK warns its citizens about anti-LGBT laws here in the US. It's the world. We've heard many stories this year of refugees who risk their lives to get to Europe. So you might think, for those who actually get there, their troubles are over. But it turns out a small number of Iraqi refugees who made it all the way to Germany are giving up and going home. Rebecca Collard has the story from Erbil in northern Iraq.
In September of 2014, Dana Mahdi Aziz decided he could no longer stay in Iraq. ISIS seized control of his town, Makmur, and the future looked bleak. He sold his taxi cab and some of his wife's jewelry and borrowed money from his family, and he flew to Turkey. In Turkey, I bought a fake passport and tried to get into Bulgaria, but they caught me and put me in jail. I stayed there for 4 days, Aziz says. I told them I'm not a criminal, I'm just a regular refugee looking for asylum. Aziz was taken to a camp in Bulgaria and told he had to claim asylum there. But he didn't want to stay in Bulgaria, so he slipped away. I tried everything to reach Germany, he says. In March 2015, he finally made it. His plan was to get asylum in Germany and establish a new life for his wife and two children who were waiting in Erbil. Aziz pulls out the identification card issued to him by the German government and the document showing he claimed asylum. Then he waited. But after almost a year, he still didn't know if Germany would grant him asylum or if his family would ever be allowed to join him. Germany is overwhelmed. Just last year, it received 500,000 new asylum applications. I had my first asylum interview in July of 2015. They said it would take 3 months. But in December, I still didn't know. It took so long, says Aziz. Then in January, my children got sick. On top of all that, Aziz wasn't allowed to work while he waited. He was living in government-provided housing on a 325 euro monthly stipend from the German government, about $365. Like many of the Iraqis who went to Europe, Aziz was the breadwinner for his family, but now he couldn't send any money home. My wife had to sell the rest of her gold jewelry to support the family, says Aziz. We're speaking in a cafe in Erbil because in February, Aziz gave up. He went to the Iraqi consulate in Frankfurt to get a one-way travel document and came home. Aziz is one of about 5,000 Iraqis who have returned since October with the help of the International Organization for Migration, the IOM. Many more Iraqis have returned on their own, unwilling to wait for assistance. At the Erbil International Airport, passengers arrive from Berlin. The security guard says now every flight from Germany is carrying some returnees. On this one, there are at least 8 Iraqis coming home after making the dangerous and expensive trip to Germany. Among them is Samad, who didn't want to use his last name. In December, he sold his land and paid smugglers to get to Germany. I just followed the other people. They were saying there's a better life in Europe, Samad says. But the reality was disappointing. I was expecting a comfortable life and that they would provide us with help, says Samad. But it was so difficult. Like Aziz, he didn't know if his wife and three children would be able to join him in Germany. And he had a family to support. We were always in the camp. I shared a room with 8 people and I wasn't allowed to work, says Samad. If there was hope I would get asylum soon, I would have stayed. But there was no hope. Syrians have a good chance of getting asylum in Germany. But for Iraqis, the future is less certain. Samad was so anxious to return to Erbil that he didn't wait for help. He spent the last of his money to buy his own ticket back to Erbil. Back in the cafe, Aziz explains that if his family had been with him in Germany, he never would have come back to Iraq. For now, he's sharing a house with his parents in Erbil, looking for work. Of course I regret it, says Aziz. I spent all my money on a goal and I didn't achieve it. Now I'm in my own country and I can't even buy a cup of coffee. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Erbil, Northern Iraq.
I don't know if you've caught the new Vice TV show, Gaycation. It's actress Ellen Page and her friend Ian Daniel traveling the world exploring LGBT cultures. They start off in the U.S.
Young people are moving past this. And this noise and this political rhetoric is going to disappear. And if the politicians don't make it disappear, they're going to disappear.
That's a reference to how far the U.S. has moved on things like same-sex marriage. So it's a little stunning that the U.K. has just issued a travel advisory for its LGBT citizens who might be thinking of visiting the States. Paul Barnes works for the Gay European Tourism Association, which helped the U.K. Foreign Office produce the travel advisory. Paul, what does the advice say?
Well, the advice just warns people, LGBT travellers who are going to the United States, that not all of the United States is the same, because the general view around the world is that the United States is a very open and welcoming destination. But we're just pointing out that if you go to Mississippi, you go to North Carolina, you might not be quite so welcome. So that's one point. And it's not really about any difficulties. It's just saying you won't really be welcome there. And one of the things that's important to us is we want to go on holiday to places where people welcome us.
When I hear travel advisory, I think of safety and terrorist violence. Is this a safety issue?
We don't think it's a safety issue so much. We're just advising LGB travellers that they need to be slightly more careful in the way in which they act in public when they travel if they're going to North Carolina and Mississippi.
And what do you advise them to do in terms of their behaviour in a place like North Carolina or Mississippi?
We're not actually giving them advice on behaviour. We're just saying to them, you need to be more careful in your behaviour in terms of outward shows of affection between same-sex couples than you would be if you went to other parts like California, like the East Coast.
Do you mention any other states or regions of the U.S. besides North Carolina and Mississippi?
Those are the only two we mention. Those are the only two where the states have gone out of their way to pass laws that discriminate against LGBT people, and therefore for travellers going to that area, they just need to be aware of that.
You work for a tourism group. Would you steer LGBT travellers away from the U.S. altogether?
No. The thing that's very clear is that we like to go to places where we're welcome, and many parts of the world welcome us because LGBT tourists spend around about $200 billion a year on travel alone. Generally, we don't have kids. We've got more disposable income. We travel more throughout the year. We can travel all year round because we're not bound by school holidays, and we spend a lot more money when we're traveling. So I think in Fort Lauderdale recently looked and saw that for every dollar that a straight holidaymaker spends in Fort Lauderdale, a gay holidaymaker spends $1.50. So we have more money and we spend a lot more. So many countries around the world recognize this and go out of their way to welcome us. And to put it into perspective, you know, the vast majority of the US is a very welcoming part of the world for us to visit. And so our advice to LGBT tourists is, by all means, go to the United States, but actually don't give your money to North Carolina or Mississippi because they really don't welcome you.
Paul Barnes with the Gay European Tourism Association in Paris. Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure.
It's not just these U.S. states that get a travel warning. The U.K. has posted alerts for LGBT people thinking of visiting Russia, China, and Gambia, among others. We've got the list at PRI.org. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. Britain's Queen turns 90 today. She's still officially the head of state of many former colonies, including Jamaica.
But I think it is now time and has been time for us to become a republic.
Why some Jamaicans say enough with the royal connection. Plus, a superfan in London says goodbye to Prince. Coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We're thinking a lot about earthquakes and the damage they leave behind. It can take years for communities to recover. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the massive quake in Nepal, and in a few minutes, we'll hear how one young girl there is coping. But we wanted to check back in on Ecuador, where a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit last weekend. My colleague at the BBC, Katie Watson, was just in Pedernales, one of the towns that suffered the most damage. I spoke to her from the airport in Quito.
So when you drive into Pedernales, it's, I mean, total devastation. Houses that have just literally kind of collapsed. Looks like a sandwich, really. You've got, you know, the first floor, perhaps, and then you've got the fourth floor, but the, you know, the floors in between have just completely collapsed. And you drive through and you just can look into people's lives, look into people's rooms. There are, you know, shower rooms that are exposed. I saw a pink high chair just teetering on the edge and belongings in the street. And you start wondering, you know, who lived there? Who are these people? And are they alive? Where did they go? It's a very kind of, it's personal, but it's just made so public. And I think, you know, you saw people walking through the streets, picking up their clothes and belongings. And this one lady was pointing to me, showing the television on the third floor that was hers, and she'd come back to try and get it. Hopefully the digger would let her up. They'd lift her up on the crane to go and get the television, partly because there are a lot of looters now, and a lot of looters have been taking the stuff that, you know, survived. So their residents are coming back before the thieves can get them. It's just incredible that that sort of thing happens.
Katie, is international aid able to get out to that area?
Yeah, we went to the stadium where the International Red Cross was. We spoke to the Canadian Red Cross. They arrived late on Sunday night. So, you know, they are getting there. It's taken a while for them to get there, to fly in from different parts of the world. But, you know, I was speaking to the Red Cross and they said that the tricky thing is it's the roads outside of Pedernales. That's just one city, and there are dozens and dozens that have been affected along the coast. So once they could get to those, you know, get through those roads, then they'd have a real idea of the extent of the damage. And at the moment, there are, you know, hundreds of people missing. People don't have the actual figure of how many people are missing. Some families have been entirely killed, and therefore whether they're on the missing list is still very, you know, unsure. I think the numbers will come out in the next few days, but it's rising slowly, but certainly isn't the end.
When you were in Pedernales, do you see the international rescue groups in there with their sniffer dogs trying to find people?
I saw some sniffer dogs. There's a lot of local manpower as well. 10,000 troops had been sent to the affected areas. The International Red Cross was there as well. But, you know, they're working with, you know, different groups. And that's actually one of the things that he said, the gentleman at the Red Cross, was that the problem is it's everybody wants to help, which is brilliant. But it's about, you know, where does each set of, you know, each international body work, and how can they work together to best kind of recover people, recover bodies, and help those who have survived.
When's the last time they found a survivor that was still alive in the rubble?
Well, I know there were survivors that were found 36 hours after the event. You know, that it's difficult times. And I was talking to one gentleman who lost five members of his family on Saturday night. Initially, after the earthquake, his daughter-in-law and her six-week-old baby were alive. But then there was a tsunami warning, so the family had to leave. She pleaded for the family to stay because she was injured, but severely injured. But they had to go, and he came back, and she and the baby had passed away. So these are the stories that you hear, really tragic stories of people who, you know, initially survived, were trapped under the rubble. But, you know, now it's going to be few and far between finding people who've survived this long under the rubble.
Katie, did you feel any of this earthquake or the aftermath of it?
Well, there were two big quakes afterwards. There was a 5.2 and a 6.1. I actually didn't feel the first one. I was awake. I didn't feel it. The second one, I slept through it. But all my colleagues got up and they were panicked. But I think it'd been very long days. So I slept through it, which is maybe a good reaction. I'm not sure. But yeah, lots of people did feel it, and they were scared.
Had you ever been to this area before the earthquake?
I hadn't actually, no. So it was a real insight, really, just to see. But I mean, the Ecuadorians are amazing. There's a lot of hope, I think. You know, you speak to people in the street who are just staring up at a building, and they'll happily talk to you. They'll explain what happened quite, you know, matter of fact, yes, I lost five family members, and be very open and talk about it. It's quite incredible. And they're picking themselves up. They're literally picking up their belongings, trying to find a safer place and trying to move on. I spoke, you know, there's one person who was saying how, you know, hope is what keeps people going anywhere around the world. If you don't have hope, you know, that's what you need.
The BBC's Katie Watson, who's just been to Pedernales, one of the worst hit cities in Ecuador. Thanks, Katie.
You're welcome.
We just heard about how people are trying to move on after Ecuador's earthquake. My colleague Sonia Narang has gone back to Nepal to find out what life is like for people there who lost their homes in the massive quake 1 year ago Monday. Today she has the story of 12-year-old Shrisha Dual and her family.
When Shrisha Dual takes me to the spot where her house used to stand in Bhaktapur, outside Kathmandu, there's just a gaping hole. There's nothing left except for a few broken clay pots, one slipper, and big piles of bricks.
There were 20 houses here. All 20 of them have been destroyed. It pains my heart to stand here. It hurts to see everyone else's houses gone too.
She says a lot of books are under the ground here. A lot of school stuff, a lot of clothes. Many of her school uniforms are still buried under the rubble. Now she lives with her mother, father, brother, and grandfather in a one-room tin shack in a camp for those who lost their homes. It's about 10 minutes away from their old home. In the camp, they have to cook outside, which means making dinner in the dark by the light of the fire. Trisha sits on the ground and helps her mother by slicing potatoes and onions. Even in these makeshift conditions, Trisha's mother is able to cook a pot full of vegetables for dinner. Trisha shows me inside the room. The walls are made of corrugated metal sheets with a tarp for a roof. Clothes hang from long wires next to large bags overflowing with yarn. She and her mother knit gloves for extra money. Trisha likes to joke about the giant rats that run around the shack.
We have killed so many already, but no matter how many we kill, it seems like we have the same amount of rats.
And there's no escape from the weather.
It's very hot in here. During storms, the wind blows the dust inside and makes everything dirty in our small room. When it rains, water leaks inside.
But as a kid, she's most annoyed by the fact the TV doesn't work properly.
Only half of the screen lights up when we try to watch TV. So I think, what's even the point?
Trisha is a really bright kid and very confident. She's in eighth grade, but it's so hard to study in these conditions with a never-ending loud construction noise across the street. And when she's at school, the other kids taunt her.
They tell me, you don't even have a house to live in. How are you living in one room?
This camp was meant to be a temporary shelter while families rebuilt their homes. But the government has been very slow in doling out funds for reconstruction. Ironically, Trisha's father is a construction worker who spends his days working on other people's homes. What little money he earns, he puts towards school fees for his kids.
I think we'll have to stay here for a long time to come.
A few days later, I join the family for the Nepali New Year. They take me up to a tiny dark room on the third floor in an abandoned building next to their old house. It's rickety and the floor shakes when anyone walks. But they're determined to celebrate outside of the camp. We drink Mountain Dew soda and eat rice and vegetables. Through the window, their old neighborhood still looks like a bombed-out war zone. I think of the other day when I asked Trisha what keeps her going.
It is the dream of having my own house one day and my own room that gives me the strength.
After the New Year's meal, Trisha, her dad, and cousins lead me through a maze of historic alleyways full of festivities near her old house. We try some of Bhaktapur's famous king curd, a delicious sweet yogurt, and stop at a temple ceremony. In this moment, Trisha seems really happy and poses for pictures. For the world, I'm Sonia Narang, Bhaktapur, Nepal.
Now that you've heard Trisha tell her story, you'll want to see her. We have Sonia's beautiful photos at PRI.org. And tomorrow, Sonia visits a remote mountain village to check on a community health worker she profiled in 2013. President Obama was in Saudi Arabia today, and in some ways, it's a make-nice trip. The historically warm friendship between the Saudi and U.S. governments has gotten tense lately. Some American lawmakers are pushing to declassify documents that might link certain Saudi officials to the 9/11 attacks. Meanwhile, human rights groups want Congress to halt arms sales to Riyadh, given the Saudis' brutal air campaign in Yemen. But despite it all, the flow of arms continues.
President Obama, of all presidents, has sold three times as much weaponry to Saudi Arabia as any of his predecessors.
That's Reuters investigative reporter David Rode. He's dug deep into Washington's backing of the Saudi armed forces.
George Bush sold about $16 billion worth of weaponry to the Saudis. Obama has so far sold about $47 billion. And this is all part of the Obama doctrine. It was really an effort by Obama to turn Saudi Arabia into sort of a military power in the region, and that they could maybe take on some responsibilities in the Middle East, and that the U.S. could then pull back from the area.
I'm curious about his image of Saudi Arabia as a military power in the region. It seems to me it's problematic, given other aspects of the Saudi kingdom. How does he square the concern that Saudi Arabia is financing extreme Islam, private Saudi citizens, but Saudi Arabia also has very negative influences in the region?
Many other Muslims actually resent Saudi Arabia. Turkey, for example, Indonesia, which is the most populous Muslim countries, they have, you know, much more moderate forms of Islam. So why are we selling all these weaponry to the Saudis? One answer is that the Saudis simply have the money. This is not American taxpayer dollars sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. This is the Saudis themselves doing it.
The other issue related to this that you go deep into detail, which is the Saudi use of these arms in its intervention in war in Yemen. Huge humanitarian disaster, lots of civilian deaths. Is the thinking that the Saudi military can't handle these weapons or is intentionally using them to cause more damage than it needs to?
The sense is that it's unintentional, that these are very advanced weapon systems and it takes any country time to learn them. But the most alarming reports have been about civilian deaths from airstrikes by the Saudis and several other Arab nations that are part of their coalition. You know, the estimate is that at least 2,000 civilians have died in bombings by this Saudi-led coalition. Just last month, two American-made laser-guided bombs apparently dropped by a Saudi airplane hit a market, killed 97 civilians, 25 of them children.
The figures are really astounding. In the people you talk to in investigating this piece in the Obama administration, do these civilian deaths concern them in terms of their decision to arm Saudi Arabia in such a way?
There's disappointment and frustration we heard from officials. And then as these deaths have gone on, the U.S. itself has gotten more enmeshed in it. We were told that there have been 40 to 50 Americans working inside Saudi Arabia in their military facilities trying to help them get their targeting better. The U.S. has shared with the Saudis software that would help them start using smaller bombs. When you're going at a smaller target, you shouldn't be dropping a 2,000-pound bomb. And those steps, though, haven't really seemed to help very much.
What leverage does the U.S. have with the Saudis in terms of the devastation they're causing in a place like Yemen?
The U.S. has enormous leverage. There are between 50 and 60 U.S. military personnel that are providing coordination and support for this Saudi-led coalition, literally working with them hand in hand. And there's 6 to 10 Americans that have been working directly inside the Saudi Air Operations Center in Riyadh. And last year, the Obama administration even decided to send more precision-guided bombs from American stocks because the Saudis were running so low on bombs themselves.
Is the mess in Yemen just something that is going to just continue? I mean, it seems like poor little Yemen, nobody's going to really jump in and do anything meaningful there. Am I reading that correctly?
Yemen's tragic. It's really a proxy war. It's the Saudis against Iran. And the big winner in all this has actually been Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. They have gained territory. They were able to get $100 million in cash from local banks, and they're operating Yemen's third largest port. Taking a page from ISIS, they're taxing boats, releasing slick videos showing all their roads they're building and other humanitarian projects. So there's now a larger, stronger Al-Qaeda mini-state in Yemen than there was before Saudi Arabia started this intervention.
Reuters investigative reporter David Rode has written a new piece about Washington's backing of the Saudi armed forces. It's co-authored with Angus McDowell and Phil Stewart. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
Up ahead, how Prince helped one British fan embrace his weirdness. It's on the world. Okay, we can't hold out any longer. Yes, it's the Queen's 90th birthday, and Britain is going gaga over it. So how's this for a present? Jamaica is thinking of ditching her as its official head of state. The new prime minister says he wants to make the island a republic. Faye Ellington is a journalist in Jamaica. I asked her if she thinks Jamaica should break ties with the Queen.
Oh, yes, I do, and I've thought so from the 1970s. Perhaps I came up in the radical era. I do like the Queen as a person. She's a warm person. I have the privilege and honor of being presented to her on one of her visits to Jamaica. But I think it is now time, and has been time, for us to become a republic.
Why is that?
it will give us a little bit more of an individualistic approach to things. And let me say that this view is split down the middle in Jamaica. There are some people believe, yes, we need to not have the Queen as our head of state. And there are others who believe, oh, we need to hang on for dear life. But I really believe it is time to give ourselves a little respectability where that is concerned, so that we do not always have to defer where that is concerned. And I believe we're perfectly capable of doing that. We do have other Caribbean countries that are republics, like Trinidad and Tobago, and they seem to be managing fairly well. I don't think we are any less capable.
What does the Queen symbolize for you?
The Queen symbolizes colonialism. Lots of people do not like to hear that word, but it's a reality. The British conquered Jamaica in 1655. They took it from the Spanish. And we know about that unpleasant past of the slave trade when Africans were brought here and the sugar plantation, and when sugar was king and all of that. And I really do believe it is time for us to move away from that kind of understanding of who we are. Yes, we need economic independence. And there's a psychological thing. Who are we? And how do we stand on our own two feet in our own national identity?
Does having the Queen as a head of state translate into real things for Jamaica?
It really is simply symbolic, but it is a kind of noose, and perhaps that is a harsh word, that it's hard to shake off. Our judiciary, for instance, you know, the wigs that are worn. This is a tropical country.
They still wear wigs, really?
Well, some of them, not all of them, you know. Our Speaker of the House, the present one, has donned that wig again. And whereas the former speakers for a number of years had not done so, there was an outcry about it. Why is Colonel Charles wearing a wig? We've long passed that. This horse hair needs to stop.
Are Jamaicans talking about this in the same way they talk about Sprint King Usain Bolt or the legalization of marijuana?
Some Jamaicans talk about it, but guess what? Our new Prime Minister, Andrew Holness, is not the first Prime Minister to say that we need to become a republic. We've been saying this from the 1970s. We've been talking about this for decades and have not been able to do anything about it.
What about Jamaicans who like the Queen, who enjoy her visits, her charity, and her loyalty to Jamaica?
I like her. I like her, and happy birthday to the Queen on her 90th. I really do like her. She's a warm person. But it's not a personal thing now, you know. It's about national dignity. It's not anything personal. It's way beyond that.
Reporter Faye Ellington in Kingston, Jamaica. Thanks a lot, Faye.
Thank you so very much. Have a wonderful day.
Finally today, sad news out of Minneapolis. The funk rock master Prince has died at the age of 57. I got to see him once. It was amazing. And my BBC colleague Mobeen Azar did too, many, many times. Mobeen is such a huge Prince fan that he made a documentary about him. Mobeen, your thoughts today on the news of Prince's passing. Why do you think he had such a huge fan base?
Firstly, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say I'm just completely devastated and in shock. I think this has come out of the blue, and it's been a terrible year in terms of people we've lost in the music industry. In terms of Prince's fan base, you know, he was someone who was iconic, not just because he wrote great songs and because he was a great artist, but he embodied what American music history is about. Elvis Presley was in that man. James Brown was in that man. Jimi Hendrix was in that man. He was a once-in-a-generation talent, and he will be remembered not only by the next generation, but I would say in hundreds of years, we will be talking about Prince. We will be talking about this modern-day Mozart.
Mobeen, you grew up in the UK. I know Prince kind of changed your life. How?
He completely changed my life. You know, I remember being a teenager, and I grew up in Yorkshire, in predominantly South Asian Muslim community. I'm from a Pakistani Muslim background. And I was, in some ways, you know, I was a bit of a kind of outcast kid. I was a bit geeky. I was a bit of a joker. And Prince, when I was a teenager and when I was 11 and 12, he taught me that it was okay to be a bit different. And, you know, in the space of a few months of listening to Prince albums, I went from feeling like an outsider to embrace my weirdness, and all of a sudden I was hugely popular, and I was popular because I didn't care about being a bit different. So I, you know, it was fine for me to wear my orange trousers with a purple shirt. I could do that because Prince was doing it. He changed my life. He absolutely changed my life.
What are your thoughts today about what the Purple One's legacy will be?
It can be summed up in one word, and that word is music. Because Prince, more than anyone else, I'd say more than any modern day pop star, because let's be honest, he was a pop star, he was a popular musician, but he sidestepped so much of what pop music is about. And you know what I mean by that specifically is the man would release albums and not do any promo if he didn't feel like it. He wouldn't do promo videos for particular albums. You know, he released albums that were constructed of 4 14-minute jazz instrumentals. With Prince, it always came back to music. That was the beginning, it was the middle, and it was the end for him. And that's what he will be remembered for. That is his legacy. He brought together so many different styles of music, and he created something so new and so unique. It will be remembered forever. You know, I need to say as well, you listen to those songs. You listen to the music from the 80s and the 90s and the new stuff. And so much of that stuff is timeless. Not only does it not fit into a particular decade, some of it sounds like it's from outer space. And he will be remembered for that.
Mobeen Azar, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today about Prince. He was truly a master. Thank you.
Thank you.
A little more Prince before we go. He died today at the age of 57. By the way, we've got some of his most famous live performances up on our Tumblr. That's pritheworld.tumblr.com. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.